But we also saw last week that when man sees God's holiness, he either runs to hide or has no strength to stand. Either way, he's utterly devastated. And thirdly, there's a war in the heavens between God's angels and Satan's demons, who also control the kingdoms of this earth. Our enemies are not men and women, but principalities, powers, rulers of the darkness of this age, spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places. And that's why prayer is so important, because we're not trying to, our battle is not with man to convince them, it's with the powers that control and have control over them. And so that's why prayer is so important. Nothing happens on earth without approval from God in heaven. Today, though, we're in chapter 11, and we're going to start, and we're going to go until however far we can get. And we're going to take it verse by verse. If we were to read the whole thing at once, it would be very tedious, and yada, yada, yada. Our brains would be fried, and we don't know who it's talking about or what. So that's why we're taking it slow. But before we get into it, I think we must address the debate that exists about this chapter and actually the entire book of Daniel. Byron touched on it a little bit, his last message. I want to get into it a little deeper. Around 587 BC, Jerusalem was attacked again by Nebuchadnezzar, by his armies, and the people were taken captive to Babylon, well, along with Daniel and his friends. Daniel lived during the 70 years of Israel's exile to Babylon and also into the Mede and Persian Empire. He probably died around 510 BC, and that's just my guess. I don't have any proof about it. But one thing I do know, he was a very old man and a very respected man, very important man. Even the angels said that as they addressed him, they addressed him as greatly beloved man. But some people place his life much later in, for example, around 160 BC. And the reason they give is that no one can predict future events that specifically in that detail. And so they say the whole book was a history instead of a prophecy. Well, what's the problem with that opinion? Firstly, from chapter 7 through the rest of the book, Daniel refers to himself in the first person and in the present tense. So if Daniel is the author, the time frame can't be 400 years later. The book of Daniel is set in the time that Israel was taken to Babylon to Nebuchadnezzar. We know when that happened. We have those dates. We know when Babylon fell to the Medes and Persians, and we have those dates. So if the book was actually written around 160 BC, wouldn't it make Daniel a liar? So here is a major problem with Christianity. It requires that we believe things that are just not possible. Like Daniel's predictions of the future, written hundreds of years before that happened. We also face additional unverifiable beliefs, Christian beliefs, like God created the heavens and the earth and all that is in it. Nobody was there. We can't confirm it. God visited Mary, and Christ was conceived without the contribution of Joseph. The resurrection of Christ from the dead. And now we must believe that Daniel predicted the future hundreds of years before it happened in specific detail, just because we read that an angel was there and explained all that to him. And then what about Moses and the plagues that he unleashed on Egypt? That's another thing that's very hard to believe. And another thing, what about the parting of the Red Sea? That's a lot to take on faith, isn't it? But when you see God's miracles exhibited in other matters like your life, it's not so hard to believe those things also. The first place I go when I have doubts like that is I go to the idea of creation. The variety and complexity of life at all its levels is very convincing that God exists. This life just doesn't happen. It's planned and carefully crafted down to its most minute detail. I don't know if you guys have ever noticed that your fingers will not be able to bend unless there was some extra skin on the top of your knuckles. Who thought of that? I know. Now, listen to this. The only source of information comes from intelligent beings. The only source of information comes from intelligent beings. For example, the basic structure of life, the human genome, contains information equal to four sets of the 26th volume of the Encyclopedia Britannica. So you take 26 books of the Encyclopedia Britannica, all the information that's in it, times four, and you get kind of, you approximate the information that's included in the very basic makeup of our bodies. That encyclopedia comes from intelligent people who researched and compiled that information into those books. In like manner, the God who created the heavens and the earth and all that is in it formed man out of the dust of the earth in all his wonder and made him able to think. God, that intelligent being, is the only possible source of biological information in the genome. It can't be by chance. Information comes intentionally from an intelligent being. Secondly, it's not that big a stretch from believing that God created the heavens and the earth to believing God intervened in his creation to save it. In order to do that, to save mankind, there were certain requirements that were set up, like sacrifice for sin and an acceptance of that sacrifice by God resulting in the resurrection of Christ from the dead. You know, if you look at the scriptures and the testimonies of so many people that have been changed and were unwilling to deny him in the face of death and suffering. Look at yourselves and the people around you that are completely new people. They don't act habitually in selfishness or greed and are not motivated by these things. That's different from the general population. It's not that big a stretch to believe that these things, God creating the universe, the virgin birth of Christ, the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and that God who knows all things told Daniel what was going to happen to his people. The only other option is to conclude that not only Daniel is a liar, but so also is God. And I'm not ready to say that. So let's see how far we can get. Keep in mind that the angel here, as he's describing these things to Daniel, is only concerned with the nation of Israel, the people, the Jewish people. Population. And the angel describes Israel, the nation of Israel, as the glorious land. And concerning Israel, it is the center of the wars that ravaged the land for around 400 years between Egypt, the south kingdom, and Syria, the north kingdom. So you have above Israel, above the nation Israel, you have Syria and all those places. And then below, you have Egypt and that kingdom. And they were constantly fighting each other. You know, so in Daniel chapter 7 through 10, there's many visions. Many were interpreted in these chapters. In chapter 9, Gabriel interprets a vision that deals with Israel's future, which is talked about the 70 weeks of years. Now in chapter 11, the angel continues to reveal to Daniel what will happen to his people. So I was wondering, I have it. There's a speaker right there. I didn't see. I was wondering if I could get a couple guys to help me pass these out. Hopefully it'll help us. Help you guys get a little idea of what's going on. Yeah, that's all I have. But let's read, while they're passing that out, let's read chapter in verse 2 through 4 of chapter 11. And like I said, we're going to take this slow and kind of get an idea of what's going on. Just one per family maybe, or, you know, we may not have enough for everybody. And verse 2, "And now I will tell you the truth. Behold, three more kings will rise in Persia, and the fourth shall be far richer than them all. By his strength, through his riches, he shall stir up all against the realm of Greece. Then a mighty king shall arise who shall rule with great dominion and do according to his will. And when he has risen, his kingdom shall be broken up and divided toward the four winds of heaven, but not among his posterity, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled. For his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others beside these. Okay, so these verses talk about the Medes and Persian, their empire. That three kings will arise, and the fourth will be much richer than the past three and rule with great dominion. He will go to war with Greece. And in 480 BC, Xerxes invades Greece, defeats the 300 Spartans at Thermopylae, and sacks Athens. King Xerxes was one of the greatest Oriental rulers of all time, with the largest army in the ancient world. So the Persian Empire did rule some of Greece during that time. Now, please remember, we started out at 587 BC when Jerusalem and all those the Jews were captured and taken to Babylon. And now in 480 BC, which is a little over 100 years, Xerxes invades Greece. But the Medo-Persian Empire, as all empires do, becomes weaker and weaker and is defeated by Alexander the Great's conquest. Verses 3 and 4 talk about Alexander the Great, who defeats the Persian Empire in 334 BC. So there's another 140 years or odd that go between Xerxes and Alexander the Great. So he defeats the Persian Empire in 334 BC, and 11 years later, in 323 BC, he dies at the age of 32 or 33. And his kingdom, which included Persia and Egypt and Greece and India and the whole known world, everything and everything in between, wasn't handed down to his children, but four of his generals. And as it says, verse 4, halfway into verse 4, but not among the posterity, his posterity, I mean, nor according to his dominion with which he ruled, for his kingdom shall be uprooted even for others besides these. So four of his generals take the his kingdom. They divide it up into the west, the east, the north, and the south, and they rule those areas. But the angel only continues his explanation about the north and south kingdom, as they are the ones involved with the land of Israel. So the chart that you have is, what it does is it gives you the actual kings and so forth of the of these two kingdoms, of the north and south kingdom. The Ptolemies are reigned and ruled in Egypt, in that area, and the Seleucids reigned in Syria and that area north of Israel. So the two kings that start out, hang on just a minute. Yeah, verses 5 through 6. Let me read those. Also, the king of the south shall become strong as well as one of his princes, and he shall gain power over him and have dominion. His dominion shall be a great dominion. And at the end of some years, they shall join forces, for the daughter of the king of the south shall go to the king of the north to make an agreement. But she shall not retain the power of her authority, and neither he nor his authority shall stand. But she shall be given up with those who brought her, and with him who begot her, and with him who strengthened her in those times. So both of these kings, as they were just starting, realized the competition and the tension that exists between them. And so the king of the south, which is Ptolemy Philadelphus, who reigned from 285 to 246, suggests an alliance by giving his daughter in marriage to the king of the north, who is Antiochus, close, Theos. But he is already married. So he decides to divorce his wife and marry the beautiful and young Berenice. His first wife, feeling unappreciated, plans revenge and murders Berenice, her attendants, and the king, whom she poisons. Yeah, that talk about the scorn of a woman, huh? Verse 7. But from a branch of her roots one shall arise in his place, who shall come with an army, enter the fortress of the king of the north, and deal with them and prevail. So this brings the death of Antiochus Theus brings to the throne a man named Callinicus. He's the new king of the north. But as verses 7 and 8 says, out of Berenice's roots, which is her brother, whose name was Ptolemy Euergetes, comes with a large army and attacks Callinicus and defeats him. The Bible says that he is Berenice's brother. The Bible says that. He carries their idols, princes, and gold and silver back to Egypt. Now, history tells us the same thing, because it says that the king of the south takes with him 40,000 talents of silver, 2,500 idols, and so forth, and that he lived longer than Callinicus. Callinicus fell off his horse and died 4 years before the king of the south. And you can see that on the chart, because the Ptolemy II ruled to 246, Ptolemy III, Euergetes, ruled for 221, but Callinicus died in 226. Now, the thing about kings is they never give up their throne unless they die. So we know that that's the case here. So the king of the south died in 221, and the king of the north died in 226, and the Bible says that the king of the south lives longer than the king of the north. Okay. Verse 8. And he shall also carry their gods captive to Egypt with their princes and their precious articles of silver and gold, and he shall continue more years than the king of the north, which I was just talking about. Verse 9, and the king of the north shall come to the kingdom of the king of the south, but shall return to his own land. However, his sons... So we continue this foretelling of the future from the angel with the next king of the north. Callinicus had two sons, but one died after reigning only 3 years, and the other was crowned Antiochus the Great. Now, he ruled until 187 BC, 223 to 187 BC. That's 36 years. And just to give you kind of some context, King David and Solomon reigned for 40 years. So he reigned for a long time. In verse 10, however, his son shall stir up strife and assemble a multitude of great forces, and one shall certainly come and overwhelm and pass through. Then he shall return to his fortress and stir up strife. History again confirms this statement by writing that he had 75,000 soldiers and attacked Egypt in verse 11. And the king of the south shall be moved with rage and go out and fight with him, with the king of the north, who shall muster a great multitude, but the multitude shall be given into the hand of his enemy. So the king of the south attacks Antiochus the Great with a great army, as recounted by the historian Polybius. He had 73,000 soldiers, 5,000 cavalry, and 73 elephants. And the elephants back then were like the tanks of today, you know. It was pretty hard to stop an elephant. So the king of the south wins, but is not stronger for it, as it says in verse 12. When he has taken away the multitude, his heart will be lifted up, and he will cast down tens of thousands, but he will not prevail. Then in verse 13, for the king of the north will return and muster a multitude greater than the former, and shall certainly come at the end of some years with a great army and much equipment. So we have these armies marching back and forth through Israel for years and decades and centuries. Can you imagine the destruction to the land of Israel that results from armies that big marching back and forth through the land? destroying the crops, stealing food, sleeping in their home, in their homes, and raping their wives and daughters. This was a time of great suffering for Israel. Let me read 14 and 6 through 16. Now, in those times, many shall rise up against the king of the south. Also, violent men of your people shall exalt themselves in fulfillment of the vision, but they shall fall. So the king of the north shall come and build a siege mound and take a fortified city, and the forces of the south shall not withstand them. Even his choice troops shall have no strength to resist. So again, it's just some more indication of this war that has been going on for centuries. It's kind of like the blood feud between the Hatfields and the McCoys, but it's not the same thing, because these kings are looking to gain more power and more control, and that's why they keep fighting one another. They want to take over each other's kingdom. So do you understand now why God allows us only to live around 80 years? You know, I mean, what kind of wickedness would we be able to do if we lived hundreds of years? And guess what? That's why the Noah's flood happened, to destroy that senseless desire of man. But before we move on, let's look at verse 17. He shall also set his face to enter with the strength of his whole kingdom and upright ones with him. Thus shall he do. And he shall give him the daughter of women to destroy it, but she shall not stand with him or be for him. Now, this is interesting, because Antiochus the Great gives Ptolemy the Fifth Epiphanes his daughter to marry, with a hidden mission that she was to spy on Egypt for him. She's supposed to warn him of whatever Ptolemy's plans are. Now, the scripture says she is the daughter of women. What does that mean? Well, it suggests that she is very beautiful, extremely beautiful. And in fact, her name is Cleopatra. So the scripture says in verse 17, but she shall not stand with him or for him or before him. That him refers back to her father. And her loyalty then is to her husband, so she never helped or spied for her father. And I guess the time frame now is around 195 BC. Now, verse 18. After this, he shall turn his face to the coastlands and shall take many, but a ruler shall bring the reproach against them to an end, and with the reproach removed, he shall turn back on him. Excuse me. After his victory over Egypt, he turns his, that's Antiochus the Great, he turns his attention to the coastlands, or the land bordering the Mediterranean Sea, as far as Greece. Guess who that puts him up against? A rising power centered in Rome. Rome's army and navy defeat Antiochus the Great and levies a tribute on him. So he returns to safety in his own land, but with anger in his heart. So he tries to plunder his own temple in his land and steal the treasure there to pay Rome. But the people rise up and kill him in verse 19. Then he shall turn his face toward the fortress of his own land, but he shall stumble and fall and shall not be found. And what that means is they kill him. In verse 20, another king is crowned. And it says he imposed taxes on the glorious kingdom. I think that meant not only Israel, but his own kingdom, as kingdom of the north. How much was required of him? Well, history says that Rome demanded 1,000 talents of each year. It doesn't say exactly what, but if we were to say that let's just talk about a talent. A talent is 70 pounds. Now, if he was required to give, say, for example, silver, 70 talents. I'm sorry, 1,000 talents of silver every year. At today's rate, silver is around $20 an ounce. There's 16 ounces in a pound. And so, each talent is 70 pounds. So, Robert, you're a math major here? No, I'm sorry. So each talent, if it was in silver, at today's rate, would be worth $22,400. And when you say 1,000 talents, then that's $22,400,000. You need some paper and pencil and show your work. Yes. And that's each year. And so Antiochus the Great tried to plunder his own temple to come up with the money but for the tribute that Rome demanded, but he was killed before he could pay it. And so the next king, in verse 20, there shall arise in his place one who imposes taxes on the glorious kingdom, but within a few days he shall be destroyed, but not in anger or in battle. So the next king had to be a tax collector. We are entering now the beginning of Rome's influence throughout the known world. Then in verse 21, and in his place shall rise a vile person to whom they will not give the honor of royalty, but he shall come in peaceably and seize the kingdom by intrigue. This vile man is Antiochus Epiphanes, who ruled from 175 to 164 BC, and he was not of royal blood and did not have a right to the throne, but gained it by deceit and flattery and bribery. Verse 22, with the force of a flood they shall be swept away from before him and be broken, and also the prince of the covenant. And I think that just means that he took over the kingdom through bribery and deceit. Verses 23 through 24, and after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. What's happening here in verses 20 through 23 is basically that King Antiochus Epiphanes makes a treaty with the king of the south. And so after, in verse 23, and after the league is made with him, he shall act deceitfully, for he shall come up and become strong with a small number of people. He shall enter peaceably even into the richest places of the province, and he shall do what his fathers have not done, nor his forefathers. He shall disperse among them the plunder, spoil, and riches, and he shall devise his plan against the strongholds, but only for a time. So, he's working to secure his power, the king of the north. Today he would be called a good politician. But the word good is not indicative of what he was and how he acted. The word politician is a very good description. But I think the word vile has a much better picture, is a much better picture of who he was. So verse 28. We're going to go down to verse 28 here. No, I'm sorry, verse 25 and 26. He shall stir up his power and his courage against the king of the south with a great army, that is the king of the north. And the king of the south shall be stirred up to battle with a very great and mighty army, but he shall not stand, for they shall devise plans against him. Yes, those who eat of the portion of his delicacies shall destroy him. His army shall be swept away, and many shall fall down slain. I don't have anything to say about that except it's just another war, another battle, more people dying, more people, more pain, more suffering. It's just senseless. They keep doing this. Verse 28, while returning to his land with, I'm sorry, verse 27, both these kings' hearts shall be bent on evil, and they shall speak lies at the same table, but it shall not prosper, for the end will still be at the appointed time. While returning to his land with great riches, his heart shall be moved against the Holy Covenant, so he shall do damage and return to his own land. So after the treaty is signed, King Antiochus Epiphanes returns to Syria, but on the way he attacks Jerusalem, destroys much of it, cruelly slaughters the people, and causes much suffering. And then verse 29 and 30. At the appointed time he shall return and go toward the south, but it shall not be like the former or the latter. For ships from Cyprus shall come against him, therefore he shall be grieved and return in rage against the Holy Covenant and do damage. So he shall return and show regard for those who forsake the Holy Covenant. So King Antiochus Epiphanes, he left the king of the south. They had a treaty. He went back up north, and then he decided to go back and get more of the riches that the king of the south had. even though the treaty is signed, he used the treaty, as much of the people today do, as an opportunity to gather more strength to make another attack. But on the way back, he attacks Jerusalem, destroys much of it, cruelly slaughters the people, and causes much suffering. Then he returns again. Now we're in verses 29 through 30. Then he returns with another army to fight against Egypt, but it's not like the last time or even earlier times, as it says, because ships from Cyprus, and that Cyprus is a reference to Rome again, they come against him. He recognizes his weakness and retreats, but shows favoritism toward those Jews who abandon their God, or they forsake the Holy Covenant and break their covenant to fight with him. Verses 31 through 32. And forces shall be mustered by him, and they shall defile the sanctuary fortress. Then they shall take away the daily sacrifices and place there the abomination of desolation. Those who do wickedly against the covenant against God, and this is talking about the Jewish nation and the temple, he shall corrupt with flattery. But the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. So what happened is this king, when he comes back, he returns through Jerusalem. Now instead of destroying it, he defiles the temple. He takes away the daily sacrifices and places in the temple a statue of Zeus, which is the main god of the Greeks. He kills a pig on the altar of the temple and makes the priests eat the pork. But what does the Bible say? It says, but the people who know their God shall be strong and carry out great exploits. Now, listen to this. It doesn't say what those exploits are. But God works much of the time behind the stage. His son was born to a little-known family in an obscure part of Bethlehem. Barn, to be exact. And it's not like the barns that we have in the country today. It was just a little shed, that a small structure where the animals could find protection from the rain or heat of the day. The angels announced the birth of the Messiah to a bunch of shepherds, insignificant shepherds. And when Jesus was sent out to start his ministry, he worked with 12 men from very humble backgrounds. He was crucified between two thieves, and even his resurrection was privy to only a few people at first. So can we still say that there were great exploits, if very few people knew about them? Yes, we can. The world knows little about what the church is doing. There's not a lot of parades and recognition. But God is still doing great things and amazing miracles in the lives of his people and to those that seek him. Okay, verses 33 through 34. And those of the people who understand shall instruct many. Yet for many days they shall fall by the sword and flame and by captivity and plundering. Now when they fall, they shall be added with a little help. Will be aided with a little help, but many shall join with them by intrigue. We come to the last of our verses for today. And looking back, one can't help feeling sorry for the people of Israel. The 70 years of exile in Babylon was hard enough. Then when they returned to Jerusalem during the Persian Empire, they rebuilt the temple and the wall around Jerusalem. The expectation that they had was that Jerusalem and the nation of Israel would be free and return again to the glory of the kingdoms of David and Solomon. Instead, for centuries more, they were trampled underfoot by different massive armies and battles and suffering. Different pagan and evil kings dominated their land. The Persian king Xerxes, Alexander the Great, Antiochus the Great, and Antiochus Epiphanes, who's considered to be the Antichrist of the Old Testament. Luke 21:24 says, and they shall fall by the edge of the sword and be led away captive into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled. The Jews experienced centuries of enslavement. Any other people would have disappeared or been absorbed by the countries that they lived in. But after World War II, the Jews in Europe and around the world began returning to Palestine, which is now Israel. The British controlled that area and tried to keep them out But in 1947, the newly formed United Nations voted to approve the nation of Israel. That in itself was a miracle. But soon after, Arab nations bordering Israel attacked with the purpose of pushing them into the sea. Israel won, even though they were extremely outnumbered. That was another mighty miracle, God protecting his people. And in Daniel 12, verse 1, it says, "At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands watch over the sons of your people." So Michael was kind of their guardian angel. So what can we take away from this? You know, it's a lot of facts, but that's what history is, right? A lot of facts. But what can we take away from all this? First of all, the history of the human race is depressing. It is constant fighting, not only fighting individually, but fighting of nations. Continually, man has not changed in one bit from the time that Cain killed his brother. You still have men who seek after power and fame and riches. None of them are honorable. No one seeks the truth or the other person's benefit. They that are in power only need the masses, that's us, to tax, to die in their wars, or to give them honor and glory. It is satisfying to see how easily and detailed God tells the future. But as you dwell on the acts of man, it's discouraging. It's like a huge car wreck that involves 50 different cars. And those people's lives are ruined. You know, some of them die, some of them lose limbs, some of them are changed for the rest of their lives. Or if you want to talk about lives that are ruined, what about those who are in our own nation that are in bondage to drugs and alcohol and have died needlessly? Secondly, we see that God knows history before it even happens and is in control of those events. He describes these years of conflict in great detail to prove to us that he does rule in the affairs of man. And if we were to go to Daniel chapter 4, we would see that verse in verse 17. But why did the Jews have to suffer so much? They were trampled underfoot by the kings of the north and the south for centuries. Then the Roman Empire ruled over them, and in 70 AD, a Roman general destroyed the temple in Jerusalem and carried them off as slaves. Some say that was to purify them. And actually, in verse 35, it says that. And some of those of understanding shall fall to refine them, to purify them, and make them white until the time of the end, because it is still for the appointed time. So it wasn't just for the 70 years of exile in Babylon. It has been over 2,500 years in which Jewish people have not submitted to the Lord or his law and have rebelled against God's mercy and his provision for atonement. 2,500 years of being in exile. Now, how important is it that Israel is a nation again, and that Jerusalem is under Jewish control? That's important. It's important to note. And thirdly, as was shared earlier, there will be a judgment, an end to all wickedness and unrighteousness. Jesus talked about it many times, so did Paul and Peter. Who will end it? It will be Jesus. His coming and judgment won't be hidden then. The coming of Christ will be like the lightning striking from the east, and the west, flashing to the west, and all will see it. Many will rejoice in his appearing, and many others will curse it. But it's not up to man. It's under God's control. Maybe a fourth thing that we will explore next week is found in Matthew 24 and 25 concerning three parables. But I'm saving that for next week to when we'll finish chapter 11.